You know what? Fuck those bitches. Plus, I'd totally do the foxy fellow again. Does not equal. Except, well, damn. Triangled. The foxy fellow is a wonderful person. Plus, we broke up, though we were never really together, never monogamous, even though he crushed my heart in this really hard to exactly define way, for which I do not fault him because I didn't have expectations. Why would I have expectations? Etc. Divided by, it's pretty clear to me that he wants to fuck my lovely woman friend who watched me bawl unabashedly over him in downtown San Francisco, and this makes me feel like puking. Squared. Plus, what is the meaning of monogamy? What is love? Do we ever owe anyone anything when it comes to sex? Why do I feel like puking if the foxy fellow is, quote, only my friend? Equals, accept adamant and profuse promises from my lovely woman friend regarding her plans to not fuck the foxy fellow. Multiplied by sisterhood. Minus, allow the foxy fellow to brush me off when I express my wish he not fuck my lovely woman friend. Equals, cry, rage, when they fail to not fuck. Plus, how could they? She promised. I thought she was my friend. He never listened to me. Less than, long, difficult, ultimately satisfying conversation with the foxy fellow that makes me feel oddly closer to him. And worse about my puny, insecure, control freak, jealous, uncool, dumbass, competitive, needy self. Squared. Multiplied by short, unproductive, decidedly cool conversation with my lovely woman friend. Doesn't it seem like she should be sorrier than this? What right do I have to an apology? Since when do I get to say who fucks whom? But she promised. Divided by fantasize that my lovely woman friend will take a long-term job in Korea. Plus, listen to my generation's equivalent of Lisa Germano's cancer of everything repeatedly while huddled into the pathetic ball of myself. Plus, alternate with trying to cheerfully compose the phrase to share some sexy fun in relation to those two selfish assholes. Doesn't equal. Except. Well. Damn. In the math ignorant world of Sugarland, we call this a clusterfuck. You are both wrong. You are both right. You both know you can do better than you did. The fact that you failed to do so equals nothing unless you learn something from this. So let's learn it, sweet peas. Triangled, if it really hurts and enrages you that the foxy fellow fucks a friend of yours, he isn't your friend, and you should not conduct yourself with him as such. He is your ex, the love you've yet to get over for reasons you may not be able to explain or justify even to yourself, the man who is an absolute no-go zone for anyone who's even remotely in your inner circle. Lose the, but we're just friends now, free love mumbo-jumbo, and own up to what you actually feel. If the foxy fellow is fucking anyone, you don't want to be hanging out with her. Not yet. Not now. Maybe not ever. At the very least, heal your heart before you go introducing the foxy fellow to your friends, especially those you'd describe as witty, sexy, brilliant, and then brace yourself. Though it may seem that friend or foe's choice to break her promise and fuck the foxy fellow is what caused all this pain, her actions are not at the root of your sorrow. What's at the root is the fact that you failed to recognize and honor your own boundaries. You tried to have it both ways. You wanted to be the woman who could be friends with a man she's not over, but you are not that woman. I understand why you want to be her, darling. She's one cool cat. She's the star of the show. She doesn't take anything personally, but you are not her, and that's okay. You are your own fragile, strong, sweet, searching self. You can be sad a guy you sort of fell for didn't fall for you. You don't have to be a good sport. You don't have to pretend you're okay with sharing your interesting and beautiful friends with a foxy fellow, even if you feel like a puny asshole not being okay with it. You can say no. But the thing is, you have to say it. You have to be the woman who stands up and says it. Not only to the lovely friend who can't possibly keep the promises she's made to you while swimming in the shared waters of your wishy-washy ache for affirmation and orgasms, but also to the man himself, Yes, the foxy fellow. The one who is, but who is not, your friend. You have to live with the uncomfortable reality that it's from him that you need time and space. And then you have to take it, hard as it is, come what may. Friend or foe, you made a choice you knew would hurt someone who trusted you. A choice, it's worth noting, you explicitly vowed not to make. And afterwards, you justified that choice with reasons you could have more thoughtfully discussed with her beforehand. This makes you neither a pleasure addict nor a terrible friend. It makes you someone who did what most people would do in this situation at this moment in your life. A woman who took what she wanted instead of what she needed. You are at once blameless in this and entirely responsible. You were sort of set up by Triangled, and you were also basically a jerk to her. The reason all that other junk came up in your post-Foxy Fellow contemplations, your ex, your feelings of being eternally punished for having wronged her, your sense that your friend never trusted you either, is that contrary to your claim that you don't regret what you did, you know you could have done this differently, better, or not at all. What's at stake here is not only your friendship with Triangled, but also your own integrity. You promised you would not hurt someone you cared for. You hurt her anyway. What do you make of that? What would you like to take forward from this, honey bun? Do you want to throw up your hands and say, oh well, or do you dare to allow this experience to alter your view? We all like to think we're right about what we believe about ourselves, and what we often believe are only the best, most moral things, i.e., of course I would never fuck the foxy fellow because that would hurt my friend. We like to pretend that our generous impulses come naturally, but the reality is we often become our kindest, most ethical selves only by seeing what it feels like to be a selfish jackass first. It's the reason we have to fight so viciously over the decapitated head of the black-haired plastic princess before we learn how to play nice. The reason we have to get burned before we understand the power of fire. The reason our most meaningful relationships are so often those that continued beyond the very juncture at which they came the closest to ending. I hope you'll do that, dear women, even if it takes you some time to stagger forward. I don't know if your friendship is built to last a lifetime, but I know the game is worth the candle. I can see you on that 10 years off porch. Yours, Sugar. Are you my mother? Dear Sugar, I moved to a new city a year ago, and in the past few months have been feeling so at home and at ease after various bouts of loneliness. I've met some great women here, women I might have seen myself being able to date at some point, or at least sleep with for a while. What is the problem with this? Well, I'm finding that I'm gravitating toward women more from habit than necessity. I pursue what is immediately available, and then lose interest rapidly, sometimes before it even starts. But because I'm a sensitive, sensual person, I have a hard time turning it away. I guess what I'm asking is this biological or emotional? I'm a male in my mid-20s, just starting what looks to be a promising career, doing what I love. I feel so much love and gratitude in my life. And just typing that sentence made me feel a bit better. I really, really love women, and don't know if I could ever just turn it off. I also don't want to end up another distant, difficult, non-communicative male unsure of his own feelings. I think part of the problem might be that I feel like I need physical love to be happy, and I'm less of a person without it. Is it more self-affirmation I need? Do I need to convince myself that I will find someone that I really can love and not just pursue because they're available for me immediately? Does this have anything to do with my mother? Anonymous. Dear Anonymous, have you ever read that book by P.D. Eastman called Are You My Mother? In it, a baby bird hatches while his mother is away from the nest, and he decides to go out to find her. He can't fly yet, so he walks. He walks and he walks and he walks on his tiny baby bird feet, constantly asking the question, Are you my mother? Each time he asks the question, he's convinced the answer is yes. But he's wrong. Nothing is ever his mother. The kitten isn't his mother. The hen isn't his mother. The dog isn't his mother. The cow isn't his mother. The boat isn't his mother. The plane isn't his mother. The steam shovel that he calls a snort isn't his mother. But finally, when all hope is lost, the baby bird gets himself back to the nest, and along comes his mother. It's a children's book that isn't really about children. It's a book about you and me and everyone else who has ever been 20-something and searching for the thing inside that allows us to feel at home in the world. It's a story about how impossible it can be to recognize who we are and who we belong to and who belongs to us. It's a fairly precise tale of the journey you're on right now, Anonymous. And from it, I encourage you to take both heart and heed. Of course you've slept with women you aren't actually very interested in having a relationship with, Honey Bunch. Of course you have. When you're single and in your 20s, having sex with whoever comes along is practically your job. It's biological. It's emotional. It's psychological. It's egomaniacal. And yes, some of those impulses just might have a little something to do with your mom. And your dad, too, for that matter. The conflicted feelings and thoughts you're having about love and sex and the occasionally contradictory actions you're taking with women are developmentally appropriate, and they'll teach you something you need to know. So don't be too hard on yourself, but do take care not to get stuck. Not getting stuck is key to not becoming, quote, another distant, difficult, non-communicative male unsure of his own feelings, who sleeps with every mildly interesting and interested woman he meets. We learn from experience. But no need to keep learning the same things from the same experiences over and over again, right? You know what it feels like to say yes to women you don't ultimately dig. So how about seeing how it feels to say no? What space is filled up by sex with women you aren't all that into? And what fills that space when you don't fill it with them? If you'd like to become the emotionally evolved man it seems so very clear to me that you're on the brink of becoming, you're going to have to evolve beyond asking every kitten you meet if she's your mother. She isn't. You are. And once you figure that out, you're home. Yours, Sugar. 10 Angry Boys. Dear Sugar, I'm a mother of 2 beautiful little girls, ages 4 and 2. They are my reason for being. I love them more than words can express. I didn't think I wanted to be a mother and often said I had no affinity with children. But my God, when my first was born, it was like a 360 spin out. I didn't know what hit me. I fell in love and was under her spell instantly. I bonded quickly with both girls and would call myself an attachment parent. The 3 of us are very close and we're a very affectionate family. I'm aware of the importance of respecting my daughter's feelings and teaching them about expressing their feelings, not suppressing them. But lately I have been losing control of my temper, allowing this demonic thing to come out of me during times of stress. Don't get me wrong, I'm not flying off the handle over trivial things like not finishing dinner or being rowdy at the supermarket. It's more of a culmination where I'm tolerating one thing after another and then I explode. I should also explain that my husband, who is an adoring father and husband, works long and unpredictable hours. This kills him because he misses being with us, but it's just the way it is. He is what I call a pure heart. He is the man who saved me, because before I met him, I was a compulsive, negative thinker. He is just pure good in the way you don't see these days. He's so gentle and fun and loving with our girls, and I'm so grateful for that, but he works long hours, so I'm often a single mom, and I feel stretched thin. Most days are good, but when I lose it, it's like gangbusters. The thing that frightens me, Sugar, is that I come from a very volatile family background. Not in the sense that my parents were raging alcoholics or freakishly abusive. They unfairly screamed their heads off and intimidated us and hit us a lot. We weren't allowed to make our own choices and were made to feel very powerless. My mother especially would unleash on my siblings and me, and often it was like negotiating through landmines. You just didn't know when she'd blow. She would say out loud that she wanted to run away. And on those nights, I wouldn't sleep until she was in bed. I truly did think she was packing her bags. She had major issues that I've learned of recently. She comes from a dysfunctional background and other circumstances that will take too long to explain here. I think this caused her to go off on hour-long soliloquies about how her life sucked and her kids sucked too. Okay. So that's the backstory in a nutshell. I'm a woman with low self-esteem who just gritted her teeth through university, got a pretty good job, married a great guy, have a beautiful family, but now I'm scaring myself because of my temper. I'm doing things that I know are not acceptable. Tonight, I grabbed my older girl out of her car seat and threw her onto our front yard. She was lying there in shock and started to cry. The prelude to this was a screaming adult tantrum during the drive home. It's almost like I can't come down until I've had my hit of rage. I feel like I totally suck and don't deserve to be their mother because I know this is wrong, but I can't stop. Today, I asked my doctor for a referral to a therapist so I can start talking through these deeper issues. I'm just scared that I'll never be able to change. And this temper and need to explode is hardwired in me. Yours, Helpless Mom. Dear Helpless Mom, I don't think you're helpless. I think you're a good mom who has on occasion been brought to the edge of her capacities for tolerance and patience and kindness, and who needs to learn how to manage her anger and her stress. You're entirely capable of doing that. The part of your letter in which you state that you believe you may never be able to change concerns me more than the part of your letter in which you describe flinging your child onto the lawn in a rage. Given your situation as the primary caregiver of two very young children with little practical support from a partner, it comes as no surprise that you've lost it with your beloved kids from time to time. I have, for short stretches, parented my own two young children in circumstances very much like those you describe, and it is, without question, the most exhausting and maddening work I have ever done. I've also behaved in ways toward my children that I regret. Find me a mother who hasn't. I don't say this to let you off the hook, but rather, paradoxically, to place responsibility for change squarely on your shoulders. Parenting is serious business. It brings out the best and the worst in us. It demands that we confront our brightest and darkest selves. Your dear daughters have given you the opportunity to see yourself in full. You are the woman who has the ability to love more deeply than she ever thought possible, and also the woman who has intermittent screaming adult tantrums directed at two people under the age of 5. The best thing you can do for your girls is to forgive yourself for what has passed, accept that your rages helped you to understand you have work to do in order to be the mother your children deserve, and then draw on every resource you can, both internal and external, to become her. Your husband's job is demanding, but surely he's around often enough that he can give you regular breaks from the family fray. Does he? Do you take them? I know how hard it can be to pull yourself away, especially when you're hungry for the rare, we're all together for once, family time. But I encourage you to find space for yourself too, even if you have to struggle to carve it out. It's amazing what an hour alone can restore, what rages a walk can quell. There are also other venues of support. A babysitting or playdate exchange with other parents, sending your children to a preschool a few mornings or afternoons a week, even if you don't have a job that demands you do so. A membership at a gym that provides childcare while you work out or sit in a sauna paging through a magazine. These are all things that help me get through the thick of it, when my very days were vast seas of young children with no grown humans around to help. The harder work is, of course, what you must do on the inside, the understanding that needs to happen in regard to your own childhood. I'm glad you're seeking counseling. I hope you'll enter into that process with a sense of strength rather than despair, because it is your strength and love that shines through your letter to me most of all. You have already come so far. That you have parented your daughters differently than the damaged way you were parented is perhaps the most meaningful achievement of your life. But there is more beyond the land of, I did it better than them. I have every belief that you'll find it, that you'll learn how to let your anger be only what it is and nothing more, a storm that passes harmlessly through you and peters out into the softest rain before it fades to sun. I once gave my heart to 10 angry boys. Though they seemingly have nothing to do with you or me or any of the basically good moms you and I know, my experience with them has informed my life in so many ways, and specifically my understanding of my obligations as a parent. I worked with the angry boys during the same time that I worked with teen girls in a middle school. My official work wasn't with these boys. I was employed to serve the girls. But because I had an office in the middle school, And because I had the job title of youth advocate, and because any program whose mission is to serve children living in poverty is invariably forced to scrounge for whatever it can get for free, I was enlisted to participate in an experiment of sorts. The experiment was this. Convince the parents of these boys, who'd all done something bad enough that they'd been pulled out of regular classes and put into a special anger management class, to come to the school to have dinner with their children as a family every Tuesday evening for 10 weeks. The program would provide the food, and the angry boys would serve it up. Each family would sit at its own table, separate from the others, in order to encourage family unity. After dinner, each angry boy would draw a card from a bowl and read what it said out loud to his family. It might be, "My happiest memory," or "My dreams for the future." And the families were meant to discuss this thing for 15 minutes. After the discussions, the families would split up. The parents of the angry boys would go into a room where they'd meet with a team of social workers, group therapy style, to discuss parenting challenges and joys. The youngest siblings of the angry boys would go into another room with a couple of interns who were assigned to babysit. And the angry boys and their older and often more angry siblings would go into a room with me, the youth advocate. Ha! The idea was that I'd lead the kids in games that would help them learn how to work cooperatively with each other without anyone trying to throttle anyone else. The first week was a disaster. One of the angry boys threatened someone's brother with a chair. Another punched someone very hard in the head when we played Duck, Duck, Gray Duck. Bingo evolved into a melee. The hour felt like four. I was actually trembling by the time we rejoined the parents and younger siblings in the school cafeteria, the rest of the building eerily dark and hushed around us. Once assembled, we stood in a wide circle. The 10 angry boys and their families, 4 social workers, 2 interns, and me. It was time for our closing ritual, one of the social workers explained in a booming voice. We'd do this every week for the next 9, she said. First, we'd sing a song. Next, we'd do a thing called rain. I didn't know what rain was, but I didn't have time to inquire. I only followed along like the rest of the group. Singing the song, it seemed the social workers had made up themselves for this very occasion, catching the reluctant eyes of the parents of the angry boys as we all pushed our way haltingly through the inanely cheerful words. There were a few men in the room, one real dad and a smattering of boyfriends, but most of the parents were women about my age, late 20s, though they didn't look like me, or dress like me, or seem like me in any way. They seemed entirely like the moms of the angry boys, like they lived on the extremes, either plainly haggard or overly dolled up, either very fat or very thin, either recently coked up or soon to be nodding off. I felt like a fraud among them. How was I going to convince their sons not to threaten one another with chairs? When at last it was time to do rain, the social worker led us through it, and I followed along again as the whole group of us collectively reenacted a storm with our bodies. We began by standing silently with our arms rounded into suns above us. Then we rubbed our hands together to create the softest hiss. Then we snapped our fingers to simulate the pitter-pat of raindrops. Then we clapped our hands, first against each other, and next against our thighs, in loud, watery smacks. At the height of the storm, we were stomping our feet on the floor in a thunderous roar, until slowly, slowly, we worked our way back up again in reverse order, through the smacking and clapping and rubbing ever more softly, until we were standing once more like sons. That was really cool, said one of the angry boys in the silence. Can we please do it again? He asked, and everyone laughed. He was the one who'd cracked the kid over the head too hard when we were playing Duck, Duck, Gray Duck. I was a bit afraid of him that first night, and not just because he was a big, intimidating brute of an 8th-grade boy. I'd kept him particularly in my sights because I knew his story. The social workers had briefed me about each of the boys, and his had stood out to me as sadder than most. 2 years before, when he'd been in 6th grade, he'd gone home from school one afternoon and found he was locked out. After he banged on the door and got no answer, he peered through the window and saw his father dead on the living room floor, overdosed on heroin. He believed he couldn't call the cops. The cops were not his friends. So he waited on the porch for his mother to come home. But she didn't come. She was a drug addict, too, and a prostitute. The boy was her only child. He spent the night sleeping on the porch, huddled into his coat. In the morning, he walked back to school and told a teacher that his dad was dead. He'd been an angry boy ever since. I'm going to call him Brandon. After that first rain, I stopped being afraid of him. He began stopping by my office in the quiet times when most of the other kids were in class. He'd worked out a deal with the teacher of his anger management classroom that whenever he felt like he was going to act in an angry way, he could leave the room and walk up and down the school hallway, taking deep breaths instead. It was a practice he'd been taught at school, and it worked for him. Up and down he went. Past my open office door. Past my open office door. Past my... Until finally he'd back up and ask, "What you doing?" in a voice cloaked in such false nonchalance that it made my heart hurt. "Nothing much," I'd say. "Come on in." And he'd sit down in the horrible story chair near my desk, where all the girls sat narrating their horrible stories. And he'd tell me his own stories, not all of which were horrible. His life was getting better, he told me. He was so happy his mother had agreed to participate in the Tuesday evening experiment. She was doing great, he said. She was getting clean, and so was her boyfriend. When summer came, they were going to get a dog. The weeks passed. The Tuesday evenings came and went. A couple of the families dropped out. Others added new members, pregnant older sisters, new boyfriends and stepkids. Every week we did the same thing. Dinner, discussion, group, song, rain. "Kids need structure," is a phrase I heard a lot. Kids like to be able to predict what's going to come next. More than anything, they love to do rain. The ritual of it made them giddy. They smacked the shit out of their thighs to make a storm. Every week, the silence in the wake of it rose off of us like a cure. I never believed the boys were angry. I believed they were hurt, and anger was the safest manifestation of their sorrow. It was the channel down which their impotent male rivers could rage. Brandon was the angriest of them all, but he was also the sweetest. He took pride in calling himself my assistant. He didn't go home after school on Tuesdays and then return with his family for dinner like most of the angry boys. He came to my office and talked to me until it was time to help me set up the food in the cafeteria. He staked out the best table for him and his mom and her boyfriend, arranging the silverware just so, then waited for them to arrive. On the last Tuesday of the program, Brandon and I taped streamers along the tables, a festive touch to honor the occasion. We had graduation certificates to hand out and donated goodie bags for the families with things like toothbrushes and board games and sets of glassware inside. We had a giant sheet cake that said, "Congratulations, families. We're stronger together." It wasn't until the cafeteria was buzzing with people that I realized Brandon's mother and her boyfriend weren't there. He sat alone at his table. He went to stand at the school's front door as the sky darkened and the other angry boys drew their discussion cards from the bowl. We split up into groups, but still Brandon's mother wasn't there. A half hour later, there was a knock on my classroom door, and one of the social workers asked me to step into the hall with Brandon. His mother had been arrested downtown. For prostitution, or drugs, or both, she didn't say. She wouldn't be released from jail until at least tomorrow, the social worker said in a steady voice. Her boyfriend would come as soon as he could. He'd stay with Brandon until his mom got back. Brandon only nodded at the news, but when I put my hand on his arm, he jerked so violently away from it, I thought he might punch me. "Brandon," I called as he stormed down the hall. "Please come back," I tried to say firmly, though my voice shook. "You can't leave," the social worker added. "We're responsible for you." He kept going as if we'd said nothing. I had 9 angry boys and their siblings waiting for me inside the classroom. I could feel them simmering to a boil on the other side of the door. "Brandon," I called more sharply, fearful he was going to run from the school. "I'm not doing anything wrong," he yelled as he turned and walked back down the hallway toward me. And I realized he was right. He wasn't going anywhere, and he'd never intended to. He was only doing what he'd learned to do, against all of his most visceral and reasonable impulses. He was taking deep breaths and walking. He was an angry boy controlling his rage. Everything about that boy pacing the hallway tells me a story I need to know. That we do not have the right to feel helpless, helpless mom. That we must help ourselves. That after destiny has delivered what it delivers, we are responsible for our lives. We can choose to fling our kids into the grass, or we can take deep breaths and walk up and down the hall. And everything about Brandon's mother tells me a story, too. We are so far from her, aren't we? In so many ways, you and I and all the basically good moms we know are not even on the same planet as that woman. She failed, and she failed, and she failed. But so have I, and so have you. What compelled her to not show up that night? What force drove her to do whatever it took to get arrested when she should have been eating lasagna and cake in a school cafeteria with her sweet boy? What was she incapable of forgiving herself for? What did she believe she was helpless to? I don't know, but I do know one thing. When it comes to our children, we do not have the luxury of despair. If we rise, they will rise with us every time, no matter how many times we've fallen before. I hope you will remember that the next time you fail. I hope I will, too. Remembering that is the most important work as parents we can possibly do. By the time the youth group ended that last night of our Tuesday experiment, Brandon had stopped pacing. He alone accepted the graduation certificate and goodie bag on behalf of his family. He ate a piece of cake. He stood in the circle and sang the song the social workers made up, and while we were singing, his mother's boyfriend arrived. That night when we did rain, it felt more significant than it ever had before. Our sons were rounder. Our hands rubbed together with more verve. We snapped and we clapped, and we stomped so loudly, it was like the clouds were dumping out their very hearts. We worked our way back from the storm, but instead of quieting, it overtook us once more, none of us wanting to stop. It was too much fun. We went on and on and on, from snap to clap and back again, raging and raging, until finally there was nothing to do but raise our arms in surrender and admit that the rain was gone. Yours, Sugar. Tiny, Beautiful Things. Dear Sugar, I read your column religiously. I'm 22. From what I can tell by your writing, you're in your early 40s. My question is short and sweet. What would you tell your 20-something self if you could talk to her now? Love, Seeking Wisdom. Dear Seeking Wisdom, stop worrying about whether you're fat. You're not fat. Or rather, you're sometimes a little bit fat, but who gives a shit? There is nothing more boring and fruitless than a woman lamenting the fact that her stomach is round. Feed yourself. Literally. The sort of people worthy of your love will love you more for this, sweet pea. In the middle of the night, in the middle of your 20s, when your best woman friend crawls naked into your bed, straddles you, and says, "You should run away from me before I devour you," believe her. You are not a terrible person for wanting to break up with someone you love. You don't need a reason to leave. Wanting to leave is enough. Leaving doesn't mean you're incapable of real love, or that you'll never love anyone else again. It doesn't mean you're morally bankrupt, or psychologically demented, or a nymphomaniac. It means you wish to change the terms of one particular relationship. That's all. Be brave enough to break your own heart. When that really sweet but fucked up gay couple invites you over to their cool apartment to do ecstasy with them, say no. There are some things you can't understand yet. Your life will be a great and continuous unfolding. It's good you've worked hard to resolve childhood issues while in your 20s, but understand that what you resolve will need to be resolved again and again. You will come to know things that can only be known with the wisdom of age and the grace of years. Most of those things will have to do with forgiveness. One evening, you will be rolling around on the wooden floor of your apartment with a man who will tell you he doesn't have a condom. You will smile in the spunky way that you think is hot and tell him to fuck you anyway. This will be a mistake for which you alone will pay. Don't lament so much about how your career is going to turn out. You don't have a career. You have a life. Do the work. Keep the faith. Be true blue. You are a writer because you write. Keep writing and quit your bitching. Your book has a birthday. You don't know what it is yet. You cannot convince people to love you. This is an absolute rule. No one will ever give you love because you want him or her to give it. Real love moves freely in both directions. Don't waste your time on anything else. Most things will be okay eventually, but not everything will be. Sometimes you'll put up a good fight and lose. Sometimes you'll hold on really hard and realize there is no choice but to let go. Acceptance is a small, quiet room. One hot afternoon during the era in which you've gotten yourself ridiculously tangled up with heroin, you will be riding the bus and thinking what a worthless piece of crap you are when a little girl will get on the bus holding the strings of two purple balloons. She'll offer you one of the balloons, but you won't take it because you believe you no longer have a right to such tiny, beautiful things. You're wrong. You do. Your assumptions about the lives of others are in direct relation to your naive pomposity. Many people you believe to be rich are not rich. Many people you think have it easy worked hard for what they got. Many people who seem to be gliding right along have suffered and are suffering. Many people who appear to you to be old and stupidly settled down with kids and cars and houses were once every bit as hip and pompous as you. When you meet a man in the doorway of a Mexican restaurant who later kisses you while explaining that this kiss doesn't mean anything, because much as he likes you, he's not interested in having a relationship with you or anyone right now, just laugh and kiss him back. Your daughter will have his sense of humor. Your son will have his eyes. The useless days will add up to something. The shitty waitressing jobs, the hours writing in your journal, the long, meandering walks, the hours reading poetry and story collections and novels and dead people's diaries and wondering about sex and God and whether you should shave under your arms or not. These things are your becoming. One Christmas at the very beginning of your 20s, when your mother gives you a warm coat that she saved for months to buy, don't look at her skeptically after she tells you she thought the coat was perfect for you. Don't hold it up and say it's longer than you like your coats to be, and too puffy, and possibly even too warm. Your mother will be dead by spring. That coat will be the last gift she gave you. You will regret the small thing you didn't say for the rest of your life. Say thank you. Yours, Sugar. Acknowledgements. Thank you, Steve Almond, for your faith in me and for your friendship. I'll always be grateful to you for your many kindnesses. Thank you to the thousands of people who wrote me letters and read the Dear Sugar column on therumpus.net. This book would not exist without you. Thank you, Isaac Fitzgerald, Stephen Elliott, Julie Gracious, Antonia Crane, Alyssa Bassist, Nancy Smith, Walter Green, and my many other colleagues at The Rumpus for your support, audacity, good work, and love. Thank you, Kristen Forbes, aka Cupcake, for your assistance and all-around awesomeness. Thank you, Robin Desser, Janet Silver, Russell Perot, Angelina Venezia, Jennifer Cardila, and all the people at Knopf, Vintage, and the Zachary Schuster Harmsworth Agency who helped me bring Tiny Beautiful Things into the world. Thank you to Playa for granting me the residency during which I completed this book. Thank you, Brian Lindstrom, a.k.a. Mr. Sugar, and Bobby and Carver Lindstrom, a.k.a. the Baby Sugars, for so much, but mostly for loving me like the truest motherfuckers. And lastly, thank you to my late mother, Bobby Lambrecht, whom Steve Allman correctly called the true original sugar. She was right. That coat was perfect for me.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Tiny Beautiful Things, Advice on Love and Life from Dear Sugar, by Cheryl Strayed. This program was directed by Lisa Bainey, executive producer Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2012 by Cheryl Strayed. Production copyright 2012, Random House, Inc., all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.